mouth. Finally, the fourth model is the one that we're most familiar with, and it is the model resurrected. The word is important first, so I'll just give you, because they use a certain word, we better know what it means. When they say he's resurrected, they're using an image, and just to give you a glance at it, but also, if I may be brief with this, I don't need to be any great length. The word egeiro is the Greek, E-G-E-I-R-O, is I raise, I awaken, and it's initial image. You might know the Greek word agora means the marketplace in a Greek town. The agora is where everybody gathers with their wares to buy and sell and where the people collect. Egeiro means to collect, to come together from X, from not being together. You come out of that dissipated or thing to be together. And the image behind it seems to be primarily to wake up. From being asleep and having your consciousness and faculties and senses all dissipated in dreams and all over the world, you wake up and you recollect yourself. You gather your senses. You think, what day is it? And gradually get yourself organized. Some of you do more quickly than others. And it's used that way all through the New Testament. I've taken a few texts there from, I think they're Matthew, actually. When he was in the boat asleep and they woke him. And it's used ordinarily for to wake up. Therefore, by analogy, a very simple analogy, it's used for not just simply waking up out of sleep, but waking up meaning get moving. You've been sitting still and you get moving. And you'll find text after text. Simon's mother-in-law was sick and then she got up. Egeiro. That's the same word. And so on. It comes then to be used by analogy for raising a person from the sleep of death now. And see the imagery, analogy, from the sleep of death back into this life, like Lazarus, John the Baptist, Jairus' daughter. They use this word that he's been raised, awakened. And so finally, naturally, by a process of growth, it's used of what we're talking about. Being raised by God from the sleep of death into the life, the consciousness, the vital movement and activity of a life after death. It's as though Jesus was asleep in the tomb, in the sleep of death, and God came down and pulled the blinds and put a little bit of light in and had a cup of tea and brown bread and Vegemite and shook Jesus and said, G'day. And he opened his eyes and sat up and had a cup of tea and then rose, if you know what I mean. He awakened him back into, not back, forward into life. Well, that is the simple word used of the resurrection. No more highfalutin than that. What it implies, however, is important, and it's no wonder this has become the key word for what we're talking about, and the key model. It implies that death has been conquered. And that's an extra. The assumed means he's with God, glorified, he's manifest. But now death itself has been, like sleep, has been conquered. He now has come from death into life. Secondly, it implies that the whole human person is alive. Not a ghost eking out some existence with God in assumed form, but that the very person who died, that whole person, has been raised, awakened into life. Where did they get the model from? Well, it's from their own literature. It's really a late idea. In fact, it emerges into their consciousness only in the second century before Christ. Up till then, they didn't know about afterlife. They knew about after existence. They went down into Hades and shades and all that. But actually, life, they weren't aware of. Till that beautiful time of the Maccabean Wars, the martyrs, the heroism of that time. And there seems to have come, as it comes in all of our social awareness, something comes and it galvanizes a social consciousness so that people kind of leap into another level of understanding that everyone seems to be doing it all over the place at the same time. You're aware of that in many things. And it seems to be just arising. And what it was the sense that surely someone as beautiful as the mother of the Maccabees and as the people who gave their life in faith, surely God, the giver of life, must take that whole person somehow into life. They imagine it would happen at the last day because he's the body in the tomb, eh? And they know that they're not fully alive yet, or they presume something's happened in Abraham's bosom or whatever. But the fullness of life they haven't kind of witnessed yet. But the idea emerges, and you find it in the second book of Maccabees, chapter 7, or Daniel 12, 1 to 3. But, and here I want to stress a few things, don't presume, and the literature on the contrary makes it clear that we're not to presume in this model of understanding. We're not talking about a body in the sense that this is a body that you're looking at. They're not talking about elbows and eyebrows and jaws. And in fact, I think it really isn't correct to read the story on the road to Emmaus as though the risen Christ there, and as though his shoulders were normal and his legs were normal and he could walk and everything else was normal, but the face was a bit different or something was strange about him. That's surely taking the painting and taking it right out of its literary genre. It's something Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 35. He asks this precise question. He says, you may ask what manner of body they have when they rise. You know, what's it like? You know, is it? And he says, that's the question mark. And then he says, this is a stupid question. It's kind of a bit heavy because we all ask it and we're all keen to know the answer. And Paul just says, look, that's a stupid question. He says, there's all kinds of bodies. You rise incorruptible, you are sown corruptible, you rise incorruptible. He goes on and on and on and on with a whole lot of analogies that are getting nowhere in a way, but trying to fumble around with different kinds of bodies. And he said, we're from the foggiest idea. But he does say something immensely beautiful. He says, when we are sown, that's now, our body is the incarnation of our psyche. It's the embodiment of our psyche. Your body, in a way, and that just means this, as well as everything around you. Remember in marriage, he says the husband and wife will be one body. So body for him is your life spirit, wherever it is. Your family is one body. Well, your body is an expression of your psyche. But when you are raised, he said, your body is an expression of the spirit. Now, I don't pretend to understand Paul, and Paul isn't claiming to understand much at all. But he is saying, I think, there's a spear going into the future, there's a pointer there, that our life, our risen body, will be an expression not of our psychological state, but of our intimacy with God. It'll be an embodiment, and now we're using analogy, of our breath spirit. And may I just remind you, the body in the appearance stories, and I've given you the data on that, all the time they're saying they didn't recognize him. They didn't dare ask who he was. She didn't know who he was. And every one of those passages has, in the painting itself, enough evidence to say, hey, watch it. Soon as their eyes were opened, he'd vanished. When the disciples on the road to Emmaus, their eyes were opened when the scriptures were opened. Their eyes were opened when the bread was broken, as it is for us. So we do use the word body because it means the spirit, real human person, embodying, and I'm using the word again, the spirit, but they're not talking about elbows and chins and fetlocks. Second, that's presuming you've got a fetlock. Don't presume either that when they say the word see, and let me not delay on this either with you, when they say they saw him, don't presume they're talking about seeing with the eyes. The seeing is an enlightenment, primarily, if not only. Matthew says they saw him, though some hesitated. So there's an indication already in there. I've gone already through the Emmaus account, how their eyes were closed and they were opened when they read the scriptures. Mary didn't see him. The disciples thought it was a ghost and didn't recognize him, but they said it must be the Lord, and so on. So the seeing, and the word for see in Greek is horao, H-O-R-A-O. From that we get our word aware, etymologically. It can perfectly well be translated, they were aware of him. Absolutely perfect translation. They were aware of him. The word seeing, the same word horao, is used for in the Gospels for blessed are the pure in heart, they will see God, but I don't think you presume you're going to see God with your eye. in the last judgment, the same word is used when, for example, in that judgment account, and it says, I was hungry and you gave me to eat, or rather, I was hungry and you didn't give me to eat, and I was thirsty and you didn't give me to drink, and so on. And they say, when did we see you hungry and didn't give you to eat? When did we see you thirsty and didn't give you to drink? When did we see you in prison and didn't visit you? And of course, they didn't see him. What they saw was me or you or anybody, eh? Their eyes saw a person. But he said, whenever you didn't do it to the least, you didn't do it to me. You should have had the seeing, the enlightenment to know that I identify with that person. And if you didn't go to that person's need, you didn't come to mine. So the word see, I guess I'm delaying on it unnecessarily. Let me just conclude then that a way of, I've put it on the notes there for you, what I've tried to express there is that primarily at least, the word seeing in these resurrection appearance stories is a perception of faith and love. Interestingly, it's the beloved disciple who sees. It's a recognition of the heart. It's an awareness and conviction born of insight as a result of revelation. It's a disclosure experience, primarily. Let me only say that, and let me leave you with an image on that point, which was brought to me once by a friend of mine. He said, and I think it's a lovely question, if one of Jesus' disciples happened to be physically blind, would he have missed anything? Putting it beautifully, isn't it? I think it's putting it really beautifully. Would he have missed anything? In other words, we put so much attention on seeing is believing. We think our eyes are in touch with reality more than the rest of us. We know it's not, but we put so much on it. What about a blind disciple? Would he have seen the risen Christ? I would say, oh yes. He would have seen him like a blind person can see so many things that none of us will ever dawn on us. Because the seeing is not an optical nerve response. It's a human awareness at a profound level. There may have been, I'll leave you with this thought for your reflection, you might want to comment on later, there may have been certain visually accompanying phenomena. Like when a person is in a severely mental state, he can or she can see green spiders climbing up a wall or something because of the disturbance, even drug-induced disturbance, and they see it. But they know they're not there, but they see it. Their eye does it. That's common enough. Visions that we have, and I'm only entering into an area I know little about here, so I just leave it with you. Visions like of Margaret Mary. Why couldn't a profound inner experience of the living God moving a man or woman deeply in a spiritual experience, why couldn't it have a transfer effect on the visual and auditory organs whereby the inner experience is projected? And because it seems invariably true that when the saints see Jesus or see Mary, they always see Jesus and Mary according to the holy pictures they've looked at, according to their socially expected environment. So the seeing is presumably a projection. That doesn't mean it's an hallucination, because the experience is genuine, it's just so overpowering that it has a visual and auditory effect. I'm not stating that, I'm just suggesting it for your reflection. The disciples had distinct experiences, human, personal. Certain definite things happened to them. We looked at some of these experiences earlier. The effect of these experiences, happening as they did to so many people in so many different ways, caused them to come to the realization in faith. Let's call it illumination, revelation, seeing. And the conviction that Jesus was alive and present in their lives and history. They articulated this belief in a number of images or models and expressed it in the appearance stories of the Gospels, particularly of Luke and John. These, like the parallel stories of Paul's conversion in Acts, express in story form the enlightenment they experienced and their conversion to faith in Jesus. He was alive. More than that, death had been conquered by God in raising him to life. This was the ultimate proof of God's love and the ultimate source of their hope. If not even death can separate us from God's love, we've nothing to fear and are liberated to live in faith and hope and love. And now to conclude this lecture. The resurrection of Jesus is the most compelling and satisfactory way of speaking of Jesus being with God and with his disciples, for it speaks of the transformation of his human nature by God. It is, however, only that, a way of speaking, an imperfect model. That Jesus is alive is absolutely central to Christianity. It's central because it's the ground of our conviction that the good news is true. God was indeed faithful and loving to Jesus, so we can hope that he'll be so to us as well. Life is meaningful, even in the face of death. It was for Jesus, we can hope it will be for us. The experience of the life of God which we have has a special Christ quality about it now. It's the living Jesus who calls us to follow him, invites us into prayer intimacy with him, inspires us to love as he loved, and enables us to do so by his present love flooding our hearts. We are able to call God Abba because we're brothers of Jesus, sisters of Jesus. He is praying for us and in us now in the presence of his Father. He's sending us now on a mission of love to the whole of creation to convince the world that it is loved and therefore it can love. There's no need now for sin or distraction or the dissipation of energy in anger, frustration and violence. Peace is possible. All of this, in fact the whole of the Christian faith and lifestyle, rests on the wonder and joy and astonishment of the amazing good news that the crucified one is indeed risen and alive and with us on our journey till the end of time. This means that while we expend our energy in trying to bring about the reign of God's love here on earth, at the same time we recognize that for us, as for Jesus, our hope is not limited by death. Death is the horizon beyond which we cannot see, but it is not the end of life. The threat of death cannot reduce us to impotence, please God, any more than it deflected Jesus from his path. There's no question of taking our eyes away from this world in which we live. We are to live here and now, and this life is the only one for which we have the appropriate tools. There's no escape from it, nor can any other worldly piety substitute for giving our lives to bring about the kingdom of God on earth as in heaven. But while we give all our hearts and minds and strength to the healing and strengthening of the human condition, we are freed from measuring everything within the horizons of birth and death. Jesus' resurrection opens up eternal possibilities. The goal of all our activity is a fullness of life beyond death. Moreover, we ought not deny or ignore experiences which seem to be the result of influences that come from outside space and time, the kind of mystical experiences that St. Paul of Tarsus had on the road to Damascus and that generation after generation of Christians have witnessed to. Of course, we can deceive ourselves and we can be deceived. We can misinterpret and we can misunderstand. But false mysticism does not rule out authentic mysticism. And if Jesus is alive in God, why could he not do what many a saint has claimed he has done and choose, love, trust, and commission us